Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. By the year 2030, at the end of this decade, millennials, those born between 1981 and 1996, will make up 75% of the workforce and hold five times as much wealth as they do today. However, that generation faces a much different economy and workplace than their parents. For one thing, they most likely won't have a defined pension plan and will have to save for retirement. And oh, by the way, they also bear the burden of paying taxes to pay for older generations' pension benefits, benefits that they never will enjoy. So what does the financial future look like for millennials? Joining us on today's program is Catherine Azales, investment consultant with Conrad Siegel Investment Advisors. Mrs. Azales, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, Jonathan Turner, author of the book Stop Faking It, Start Making It, Millennials' Guide to Real Wealth Creation. Mr. Turner, good to see you this morning.
Hey, nice to see you as well.
Also joining us is James Honchar, who is Senior Human Resources Business Advisor with the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency, or FHEA. Jim Honchar, good to see you too.
Morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You don't have to be a millennial to give us a call and ask a question. I mean, most of us who are the parents of millennials have questions about their financial future as well. When to start this program, and I have to admit that one of the reasons we decided to produce this program today is that we received an email from a listener, a self-identified millennial, and she was not able to be here today, but want to read a little bit of her story and ask how typical this is and some of the challenges that she identifies. I graduated from a four-year college with a degree in a competitive field. Unlike many of my classmates, I was able to gain full-time employment in the field of my degree right away. Now, this job included benefits and a 401k. After a year and a half, my 40-hour-a-week job somehow evolved into a 90-hour-a-week position with no change in payment or benefits. After giving voice to my concerns over a lack of home life, I was given an ultimatum to sign something saying that I would not sue the company for the hours worked. It was a nonverbal sign this or be let go. I quit. In the 5 years since this took place, I've had a series of lesser paying jobs as I've been working in the nonprofit sector by personal choice. Any savings I had from my position disappeared into student loans and medical bills. I'm in a similar boat to many of my friends. We're just able to keep up with paying off student loans, rent, utilities, and groceries. In a cycle, we're able to put a bit of savings away each paycheck, but without benefits, any trip to the doctors or any breakdown of our vehicles means we are practically back at square one. If retirement is built upon a three-legged stool, Social Security, personal savings, and 401ks, how is anyone in our position going to retire if two of the legs are broken and personal savings are more of a stump than a true leg? So my question is, how typical is that story for people in the millennial generation?
I would say far too typical. Mm-hmm. And just like Catherine here, I've come from the financial industry. And what led me to write the book was by working with a lot of my friends. Once I got into the career field, I'd say about 4 years into the industry, some of my friends started coming to want to work with me. And right away, I realized just how bad it was for them. There is no concept of money management at all. And so you're graduating from college, you're entering the workforce, or you're just entering the workforce right out from high school, and you've never been taught, let alone how to balance a checkbook, but not how to use a credit card, what APR means on a credit card, or how you should be paying the credit card off, how you should manage money. And the biggest problem of all is there's no discussion ever about what money really is. And I always talk to everyone that money itself is nothing more than a tool. And like any tool, if you don't learn how to use that tool properly, and then if you don't use it the right way, you're not going to be able to do whatever you want to do with that tool. It's going to break. And everything that you do then subsequent to that in its usage is also going to break.
What you're describing, though, sounds like a lack of financial literacy.
Absolutely.
100%. Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that.
Why do you say that, Catherine?
I mean, well, just to your listeners' points, I mean, I've lived that. I think it's absolutely what we're all experiencing as far as in the millennial generation. And I think millennials, oftentimes, we get a bad rap. We all know the stereotypes out there. And we've grown up hearing those phrases like retirement crisis. They're all thrown around, and we've watched our parents weather that financial crisis and some challenging times such as the recession in 2008. And we all know that planning is important. But overall, there is a lack of education around the topic. And there's a lot of competing demands for our money right now.
Okay, mm-hmm. But what's different, though? What is different than what prior generations have faced that younger people are facing today?
Go ahead, Jim. Chime in here. So one of the things that I think is often overlooked is we have a generation that came out of college or came out of high school or trade school and entered into the workforce in one of the worst recessions of our lifetime. Mm-hmm. Complicate that with the fact that those that did go for higher education, whether it be community college, higher education through college or trade school, is averaging about a $37,000 debt right out of school. That is unprecedented.
Pennsylvania has one of the highest student debt rates in the country, if not the highest, right?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
So if you take all that into effect, you know, we had a generation that came out, not only had this debt, but was, if not unemployed, was underemployed. And you're immediately being required to pay for your student loans, plus you have your regular cost of living, you're looking for health care, food, rent, car payments, everything else. So I think this is a generation that has faced more challenges than we've ever seen in the past because of all those complicating factors.
Let me add something to that. There was a study conducted by the Federal Reserve of St. Louis and released last month that found that millennials trail past generations at roughly the same age mm-hmm. in wealth accumulation. Yep. Now, these figures are startling. I mean, the one to me is shocking. Big difference in those who have a college degree and those that don't. And by a college degree, I assume they're also including, it's not just a bachelor's degree, but someone who has graduated from trade school or something like that. Millennials with a degree had about 6% less wealth than expected based on the typical wealth of this at the same age by older generations. Now, here's the part that really, I think, needs to be addressed. Millennials who didn't have a degree had 44% less wealth than expected by people of their same age. Yeah. That right there, probably, if you're looking for reasons, you can look at the economy today. Our parents' generation, the subsequent generations, it was not untypical for them to graduate high school, get a job, a manufacturing job, making a good money, having good pension, that kind of thing. That doesn't, I won't say it doesn't exist, but it's very rare today.
Right, things are delayed, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And
so those numbers, what do they mean?
Well, I mean, this kind of goes in perfectly what I was going to follow up and say, going back to the baby boomer generation, 16% of all baby boomers have a college degree. So that means 16% of the baby boomer population graduated from college and then entered into the workforce. Back then, a college degree meant something. And there was also less college degrees out there. College degrees were very specific and very focused. As time went on, colleges started to open up the doors to anyone. And I wrote in my book, it was like Oprah Winfrey when she was on her show the one time. She's like, you get a car. College was like, you get a degree. You get a good degree. Degrees for everyone. And they were just handing these things out.
But that's
out.
A good thing, though.
No, you
don't think so?
No, because millennials, 40% of our generation holds a college degree. And if 40% of our entire generation is holding a college degree, that means the degree now holds less weight than what it once did, which means it's now been watered down to essentially the same thing as a high school diploma almost. Mm-hmm. And so as we go to enter the workforce, now also coming off of the recession, there's less jobs out there, and there's especially less jobs that are focused on degree-specific careers, you're going to have a problem because you're going to not only have the people that went to college become underpaid, but those then that didn't go to college or any higher education potentially are now competing with 40% of the workforce that is already not being able to do what they want to do because of the way the world just existed for the past decade.
Jim, you and I are baby boomers.
We are boomers.
We're probably the oldest ones. Oh, Craig's here. All right, we're the second oldest in the room. But anyway, what's changed in the workplace? What's different now for workers, younger workers today than what was for when we were millennials?
So we're seeing a bigger change, and I think the panel here will agree that employers are often slow to change. You know, you had mentioned at the outset of the program that a big population of the workforce right now is going to be our millennials and will be throughout the rest of our lifetime.
75% within the next 10 years.
Correct. So what we are seeing is we are seeing employers starting to adapt to that. So we are seeing employers offering more flexibility in their total compensation packages. So it's not just everybody gets the standard salary, benefits, healthcare, retirement. You're seeing a lot more in the way of you come in, you kind of have a menu or a cafeteria style where you can pick from. And I think that's really important, especially with Catherine and Jonathan here, to have someone educated enough to know what is it, what is my right makeup of my total compensation package that I need to not only cover my debt, but also have adequate healthcare and also provide for my future.
Healthcare, you know, again, prior generations probably never thought of healthcare as an essential. Yeah, we talk about, it has great benefits. But with that, we probably thought, okay, we did have good healthcare. It had a pension, a defined pension, something like that. But nowadays, I get the sense that because millennials have heard so much about healthcare and it is so much more expensive than it was in prior generations, that this is very important, Catherine.
It's absolutely important, and it's as far as trends go, you are seeing more of it being put back on to the individual, and that's another competition for the financial situation for people, millennials, as they're navigating this financial world.
We also have heard student debt mentioned. Jonathan, give us a sense of what role student debt plays in this.
It's absolutely predatory is what it is. And student loan debt, I mean, the average debt right now for millennials, just student loan debt, is about $39,000, give or take, across this entire country. And you also then roll into it the average credit card debt, you're talking almost $45,000. And I'm being a little bit liberal with these numbers, but you're in that range. Now, student loan debt, one of the biggest problems that causes that issue is, again, the lack of financial education and money management, any literacy at all. So when you're in high school and you have these college days, the college fairs, they all come to your local high school or they're somewhere out in the area and you go to them, there's always a bunch of banks that are there. And the banks always have these big signs that say, hey, come on over, let's talk, let's figure out how we're going to help you go to college, right? We want to help you invest in your future. And in reality, all the bank's really doing is saying, we want you to give us all your money. Because there's no discussion, hey, all right, when you graduate, you're now going to pay 7% interest and you can't get out of this. Even if you lose your job, you file for bankruptcy, you're stuck paying this loan. The only way out is you pay it off or you die.
Or Jonathan, you've seen this on the college campuses. You have the table tents everywhere.
Oh, and yes. Yep.
There's a free T-shirt enticement for you to sign up for multiple credit cards. And
exactly. I was going to get there next. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. So it is. It's predatory, which is a great example.
And what happens is you have all these people, again, 40% of our generation's going to college. So more of us now are going to college. And that means the banks are handing out more loans. Now, the fun fact that most people don't realize is these loans are guaranteed by the U.S. government. The government makes sure that these loans are going to get paid back no matter what. And so it's a direct issue going all the way to the higher ups in Washington. I'm not going to really touch on that a whole lot, but as far as the debt itself, if you just had a class that was taught when you're in high school, say your junior year or your senior year, that said, here is the way the world works. And if you want to go to college, here is what you should consider. You should consider that you would be paying X amount when you leave college, that means that you should be considering a job or a career field that's going to pay you Y. And also, you have to factor the cost of living. So you're going to have cost of living, whether it's an apartment or a home, food, clothing, utilities, you need a vehicle, and then also you need to pay back your student loans. So you need, let's just say hypothetically, $80,000. And if you're going to get a career that's only going to pay you $40,000, guess what? The system is not going to work. Your ship is sunk.
Jim, you work for FEA, Higher Education Assistance Agency. I want to bring you into this conversation. I have to take a break, but I want to bring you into this conversation about student debt in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Check out some of the upcoming topics for the program at WITF.org/smarttalk. Some of the programs we're working on include talking about racism, getting healthier in the new year, and the year ahead politically. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. On today's program, we're talking about millennials and preparing for their financial future, and eventually we'll talk about retirement as well. Our guest today, James Honshire, who is Senior Human Resources Business Advisor with the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency, or FEA. Jonathan Turner, author of the book Stop Faking It, Start Making It, Millennials' Guide to Real Wealth Creation, and Catherine Azales, investment consultant with Conrad Siegel Investment Advisors. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I'm going to take some phone calls and emails here in just a moment, but Jim, working for FEA, I mean, this is student loans, student debt is what you're working with all the time. We've had a discussion here about how much of a burden that is on millennials and even other generations that are just graduating from college as well. Tell me about it, and is there anything in the works? What can someone who, okay, as Jonathan described, loses their job but still has to pay back those student loans, what can they do?
So there are a couple of things, and I think we are pretty fortunate to be in Pennsylvania because there are a number of options that Pennsylvania does to help higher education. I mean, that was the premise in which FEA was created back in the 1960s and exists. To provide some assistance through grant programs, through various funding assistance programs. The other thing that I think has really happened very recently that we have partnered with Governor Wolf and the legislature is putting forward the PA Forward Loan Program. So this is a very competitive loan program for not only new students, but also we just launched our refinance program, which provides a much more competitive rate than you would find out in a bank or a credit union.
Like what? What kind of rate?
It really just depends on the individual's credit score, what their background is, but it is very competitive because we're getting funding to start this. Our seed money actually came through the state legislature and the governor. So we actually were able to provide a much more competitive rate, lower than the 7% that Jonathan had talked about that you generally find in the commercial world. So that's not only for just new loan programs, but it's also, we just launched a refinance program as well for those that are in Pennsylvania.
But something, just as you were answering that question, I was thinking about something we had talked about earlier, financial literacy. When you said it depends on a credit score, a credit rating.
It probably
takes a lot of us a few years to realize that the decisions we make on our finances, that there are real repercussions. And let's face it, those credit scores are used for much more than just getting loans nowadays. Yeah. Maybe an apartment, maybe a car, well, definitely a car loan.
Absolutely.
But there's a lot of things that. So this gets back to our original discussion about financial literacy. Do millennials, and I don't just mean millennials, but do a lot of young people understand the consequences of not paying back those loans on a timely basis, those running up credit card debt, getting into too much debt?
There's plenty of examples that I've seen, and I can speak personally. I grew up in a family, baby boomer parents, they worked jobs that they worked for 35, 40 years, healthcare benefits paid for, pensions. And they just were not financially educated because everything was kind of prepackaged for them. So they didn't really have to navigate that world too often. And not only that, but they just were not financially sound. So that's really what led me to get into what I'm doing. And because of that lack of education in there, out there in the system, you really do not get educated on these topics.
But, okay, quick question for you, though, a personal question.
Sure.
Did they pay for your education?
No, they did not. I'm still paying off those student loans.
All right, okay. Yeah. Jonathan, your book, the title of it, Stop Faking It, Start Making It, Millennial's Guide to Real Wealth Creation. When you say stop faking it, start making it, this kind of goes into what we're describing here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole premise for the title was really more of the jab at not my generation, but just everyone that online, because everything today seemed to go online. And if you go online, everyone is living their best life. Everyone has a six pack. Everyone's got the dream spouse, the dream life. And there's a lot of people that are predatory then that take advantage of that and sell that to people when it's complete just bogus information. And people constantly are willing to open up their checkbook or their credit card and pay this amount in hopes that they are able to attain it. And that was the biggest reason why I wanted to start to write this, was to show people that no, it's not, there is no easy way, first off, to creating wealth. And wealth itself doesn't always mean the material stuff. And when I interviewed people, I did 1,000 people that I interviewed and asked them what their definition of wealth was. And the resounding response was the private jet, the house, the car, the vacation, stuff like that. And I was like, oh, really? And then there was a handful of people that say it's being able to provide for my family. It's being able to be there with my children.
Which
and
is more realistic.
It's absolutely more realistic. And it just goes to show. And again, I asked the question, though, very vague, because I didn't say, what does wealth mean to you? I said, when I say the word wealth, what do you think of? And people say that because that's what's ingrained in their brains on the media and in social media. We've become a very materialistic world. And because of that, everyone is going after the material things and trying to use their money to get the material things, which of course goes back to saying we go in this cycle of debt, because the only way you can get that, if you don't understand how money works, is you're going to end up in debt to attain it.
Let's go to the telephone and some emails. George from East Berlin said, I paid into Social Security for 40 years, and now that I'm on it, I make enough to barely make it. I'm a little bit resentful of millennials saying they're having to support us. The tax burden could be eased if the top 1% were taxed on a different scale than the majority of workers. Couple things here. There, Social Security, when we said earlier, when I said in my introduction that there will be, millennials will be paying taxes to pay for, and what I was referring to there was pensions for the most part, because pensions, Pennsylvania, former retired employees, public employees, and educators, I think it's up to $70 billion now in debt on that pension. I think every state in this country, maybe one or two, has a pension debt. There are many private employers that either got rid of their pensions, changed them, or they're not what they are today. So that's what I was referring to when I was talking about the millennial generation, or even the generation after that, paying for a retirement benefit that that they'll never get to see. Now, as far as Social Security goes, yes, the people who paid into Social Security did pay into it. They've earned that. But let's face it, the reality is they didn't pay in enough to make, because they're living longer, for one thing.
Right.
There are a lot of different factors that go into this. Who'd like to address that, you know, George saying that he's a little bit resentful of millennials saying they're going to have to prop up older generations?
No, I can appreciate where he's coming from, but the retirement landscape is different, and I think that he could probably admit that as far as what the millennials are facing, it is different than the baby boomer generation. There's a lot of challenges around student debt. We've talked about that, increased life expectancy. I read a report over the weekend that the first child, baby, to live to age 200 has already been born.
What?
So
200.
So
that'd be nice.
Oh man, I don't know about that.
I know, it sounds
like, as long as I look like this, though, keep the hair, I'm good.
John, I don't think you're going to.
But and then not only that, but just job hopping. There's a lot of people in the millennial that category that, because employers have changed a lot, they're not staying with their employers long, and that creates some challenges around retirement. But specific to Social Security and kind of where the financial world is going, we've seen a lot of recent legislation that does change the factors for millennials around retirement and some burdens there, as well as Social Security, mm-hmm. that will make our retirement landscape different.
Mm-hmm. It's Jim, also, what were you going
to say? Oh, no, go ahead, Jim.
So to Catherine's point, I mean, you and I, as baby boomers, about half of us really rely on Social Security as a big part of our pension. If you look at the current generation, it's about 19%. So they really aren't counting on Social Security.
And can I interrupt for just 1 second? I mean, most of the polls show, and I don't think you have to be a pollster to figure this out, that most people in younger generations, say under the age of 40, don't think Social Security will be there, or at least in its current form, correct. When they retire.
That's correct. And on top of that, there's now a new concept called the four-legged stool. And that fourth leg is many of the current generation feel that they're going to be working well into their late 60s and 70s.
Right. Jonathan, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say the problems that we're having with Social Security and with pensions in today's world, they're from 20 years ago. And it's from just gross mismanagement of the pension systems and Social Security. I mean, if you go back through history and look at pensions, most of the times when pension projections were done, and this still happens today, which just drives me up a wall, companies will do their annual projections of what they think their rate of return is going to be for their accounts in the pensions. And on average, they're around 8%. Well, you're not getting that every single year. And if you're going to continually project much higher rates of return than what is actually coming into that pension account, it's never going to work. And the same thing happened with Social Security. And we've gone now a decade of very, very low interest rates where that rate of return just was not, it wasn't attainable in any way, shape, or form. And I understand what he's talking about. Absolutely. I feel that where we're complaining as millennials saying, well, we have to cover the baby boomers, and the baby boomers, well, no, it's our right. We're entitled to, we paid into it. And it's actually neither of our faults. It's the mismanagement of the system that caused this, because back then they could have said, we have a problem. We need to either grossly lower our projected rates of return, and that means we need to put more into the system, or they should have continued to be paying in a much larger amount, or delayed rates, or like age of retirement, whatever it is. There's ways that could have achieved it that could have made this issue much more attainable than just saying, you know what, we're going to kick the can down the road. And now that the problem is in front of us, that you can't just delay it. You've got to make a drastic change. And that's the problem that we face every day.
I mean, what you're talking about with pensions, that you know, some of the factors that have contributed to that are that there were employers, including the state, that did not pay into what they should have.
Yep.
They didn't contribute what they should have. You talk about 2008 and the recession. There were many investments that were made that did not come back with what was expected. What else? I mean, there were some other that life expectancy is a big factor as well. So those are all things that go into this. We have a couple other emails for people who are Gen Xers, and maybe we should identify these generations, because I have to admit, maybe it's because I'm a baby boomer, that I can't keep the letters, the generations straight. Gen X is what?
They're between the baby boomer and millennials.
So 65 to 80, 1965 to 1980 are Gen Xers.
Okay. We have a couple Gen Xers who say that they've been in this situation since they graduated high school. Pensions stopped existing. Student debt went up. And parents didn't save in the Gen Xer time period as well. And again, says that another Gen Xer says, we could not have had their parents' insurance until they were 26. Gen Xers could not get jobs in their field. Gen Xers were told to go to college but failed to get into their field. Millennials will inherit wealth from their boomer parents. When their parents die, Gen Xers don't have boomer parents. We sound like we have a generational battle going on here online.
Yeah. They call it the lost generation. It's a nickname for the Gen Xers because of those circumstances right there.
Yeah, and an interesting statistic is you actually have about 10% more millennials participating in an active retirement plan than you do Gen Xers.
Right.
So Gen Xers, it's about 36%, where millennials, it's 45% actually have a current retirement plan that they're actively participating
in. That is one of the main topics for the program, and I'm going to discuss that in just a moment. First, let's take a call from Sherry in Lewisburg. Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm a college professor, and I know in Pennsylvania, we are all scrambling over trying to attract students to our schools here. It's really hard to fill our classes. And one thing that struck me is my son goes to school out of state, and he has a campus job. And because he's in a different state, it pays a lot more because the minimum wage is a lot higher. And I was just doing a quick calculation while I was waiting for you to take my call. And what I saw is that at $7.25 an hour, which is what most campus jobs are going to pay in Pennsylvania, if a student, a work study student, is working 15 hours a week, which is probably about average, some work more, some work less, that student is making $1,522.50 in the semester. The student has a campus job in Massachusetts, that student is making $2,520 a semester. So in terms of, you know, these are hardworking kids. They're eligible for work study because they come from a particular financial background. And it seems like raising the minimum wage is, yet this would be another good outcome of raising our minimum wage and helping these hardworking young people get a more firm start in life. And it would also probably help fill our classrooms in Pennsylvania colleges.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, she's talking about minimum wage and a specific part of the population, those still in school. You know, I don't know if raising the minimum wage would have much of an impact on kind of what we're talking about, saving for retirement, when you're living paycheck to paycheck to be able to afford to put food on the table. But she is talking about a specific population, those who are working to help pay their help pay for their tuition. What about that? Right? Minimum wage, raising that, would it help at all?
I think you could do a whole show just specifically relegated to that topic, as I know you do. But I think that there's a lot more to it. But as far as kind of speaking to that topic, I think that what she's talking about as far as the student working while in college, those types of things can alleviate that burden when they do graduate on that level of debt, which is all helpful. And that's not always something that people do, students do through college.
Yeah, and to follow up with that, something to be attractive, as she was asking, how can colleges get people, more students to come in? I mean, if you do raise the minimum wage to just working students while they're in college, I look at it like this way. It's not going to solve anything if you're not teaching them how to manage that money, because they might have a little bit more disposable income while they're in college, but if they're not saving it, it's going to end up in the same spot that they are already, like graduates are right now.
Right.
Ways that colleges might consider is create actual courses around money management. Have maybe an entire semester that's based on just the world itself. And I don't mean about
Jonathan, that
economics.
Sounds like it's too late, though. I mean, you had talked earlier about junior in high school. I mean,
no, it could be too late. I'm trying to spitball here, because by no means am I prepared to try and answer this question the best way, but it's just something that comes to mind is some financial literacy or something that's going to prepare people while they're in college might make it more attractive.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, and this is something that we postponed from earlier in the year, which was, you know, last week. How's the New Year resolution going so far about getting in shape? We'll have a conversation about fitness, about nutrition. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Also, visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. You can leave a voicemail or a voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Welcome back to today's program. Our guest today, Catherine Azales, who is investment consultant with Conrad Segal Investment Advisors. Jim Honshire, senior human resource business advisor with the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency, or FHEA. And Jonathan Turner, author of the book, Stop Faking It, Start Making It, Millennial's Guide to Real Wealth Creation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We've got a lot of emails here. I'll try to get to as many as possible. Nancy called, and she says, frugality is important, and no one is thinking about that anymore. This is a philosophy of living. Choice of college majors is important. Pick a field that is focused and can end in a job. My Social Security is being docked by holdings. The IRS has looked at income taxes and deducting from my Social Security that I have paid for. Let's talk about what she said about being frugal, though. You know, it's so funny how a lot of this conversation goes back to financial literacy. Yep. Frugal means just what you described, Jonathan, of you know, spending money, only money that you have, or buying something or paying for something that you can afford.
Yep.
But when it is being offered to us that, okay, here's something that you're told that you need. You need, I mean, it's obvious that today just getting a college degree, graduating from college, is not going to be enough. You must have some kind of education post high school, but you have to pay for that education, whether it is a four-year college, whether it is a trade school, which probably many more students should take a look at. But it gets back to planning and being frugal and having the willpower to say, you know what, here's what I want to do. I just can't afford it.
Yeah. And actually, frugal, I don't know if that's the best word for it. I would say mindset is the better way to describe it, because really, when you want to look at money and look at wealth, going back to what I said earlier, using money as a tool and thinking about money as a tool, you want to figure out where can that tool work for you and how can that tool build your future wealth. And so, for example, looking instead of going out and buying the materialistic things early on, so many people want to get go on the vacation so they could post them online.
Wait a minute, Jonathan. In the cover of your book, you're posing with a Corvette.
Oh, McLaren.
Oh, it is? Okay. Yeah. All right. I did a quick glance at it and saw it's yellow, though.
Orange.
See? Okay. I'm at age now where that's another thing. We start losing our memories at this point. Okay. So an orange McLaren. All right. Yeah. So go ahead. I'm joking with you.
And I did that pose because that was directly as a jab to a lot of people that do post these self-help gurus and everything else, where they always pose in front of a rented Lamborghini or something, and they're on a private jet, or really it's a Delta Airlines flight going to Orlando, but they just take the picture in the right spot and say, you know what, here I am. And so, like, I've been a person that's been on both ends of this, where I came out of college, I got into my career, and right away I was doing everything that I'm talking about right now that you shouldn't do. I not only bought my first townhouse, 3 weeks later I bought a car that I had no business buying. And I was using my credit cards to literally just do everything, and guess what happened? Like, I got into a period of time where I had a lot of freaking debt. And I had to figure out how I'm gonna get out of it. And it took a lot of understanding that, yeah, maybe I don't need this car anymore right now for a period of time. And because I'm a car person, so that to me, I was like, I need to restructure my life and figure out what do I need to do so I can actually afford that kind of lifestyle, what I'm after. Now, to me, it's not the material stuff. I just love cars. So my vision of a perfect life is I have a 2,500 square foot, 2,000 square foot house with my wife, and we have a 20,000 square foot garage. Like, that to me is everything. So that's what I'm trying to attain. But going through and figuring out, well, what do I need to actually not only have coming into my household, but what do I need to be paying myself? Investing into something that's going to give me a paycheck also, so that way I can go out and do this kind of stuff and have the cars and do the racing and all that other stuff. And that's going back to the frugality part. It's not really being frugal. It's having the mindset to understand how to use money in the proper manner and use it as a tool. And there's many ways to use it. There is no secret to success also. There's no secret to building wealth. It's you need to figure out, first off, what is your definition of that lifestyle? Be as crystal clear as you can with that definition.
And realistic.
Yeah, be realistic. And once you know that, then you can reverse engineer. And I tell everyone that I work with this, you always want to start with the end in mind. Figure out where you want to see yourself, and then you can reverse engineer what you need to actually do.
And Scott, can I jump in and just say that I think, to Nancy's point, I think frugality is important to an extent, but I still think that every generation does face challenges, and there are some fundamental challenges involved with the millennials and saving for retirement. But I think that frugality is one word, but priorities is another word.
Bingo.
And I think that, you know, we have to learn how to juggle all these responsibilities with retirement planning in mind, because if not, there's going to be too many demands on that dollar that millennials are trying to stretch. And retirement, unfortunately, will end up back burner. And then people will be underfunded for retirement. And then taxpayers are going to be footing the bill at some point down the road, or just kicking the can down the road. So I think that, you know, a common piece of advice is to pay down all of your debt first and then save. And if you think about it, that really might not be the most advantageous if you really can try to juggle all those responsibilities and do that effectively.
Jim, you had mentioned some statistics earlier about millennials and Gen X savings or for retirement. What were they?
Right. So we have we actually have more millennials saving today for retirement than they do Gen Xers. And I think it goes back to your original point. Gen Xers are kind of the lost generation. They don't have the inheritance that they received maybe from other generations. They were faced with a lot of debt. But you do see the current generation actively participating about 10% more than our Gen Xers.
45%, if I remember correctly, you said of millennials. Are participating in a retirement savings program. How does that compare with boomers? I mean, obviously, as you get older, you think more about retirement. I mean, I'm sure there are people who get to the age of 50 and say, "Uh-oh, I better start saving for retirement." But how does that percentage compare to, say, baby boomers?
So I don't have the actual percentage, but I think the trend generally is a lot of us baby boomers had relied on the traditional defined benefit program.
We took it for granted.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is going to sound kind of odd, but there's actually a silver lining to the defined benefit program going away. And that is, especially with employees moving from careers to careers, they have a lot more flexibility with a portable retirement program. Otherwise, you have someone that is kind of quote-unquote stuck in a job for 20, 25, 30 years, and what we kind of call the golden handcuffs. It's like, I can't go anywhere because I have this
great benefit.
I'm not going to leave. That's not good for the employer or the employee, because you have someone that at best might become complacent as opposed to committed to their actual career. Mm.
Catherine, this gets back to the original reason that we did the program, the young woman who emailed us and contacted us about her situation said that, you know, she was tired of hearing about the stereotypes of millennials, that millennials didn't care about retirement. So that 45% may surprise some people that it is that high that millennials are saving for retirement. What do you see? What's your observation at Conrad Segal about younger people? And by younger people, I mean people under the age of 40 for the most part, thinking about retirement.
I think that they're well aware of the challenges and that it is a priority that they need to plan for. And I do think that millennials are weighing those things out when they are searching for jobs. In combination with that initial salary rate, which I think is oftentimes what a lot of people focus on, but I think more and more millennials are focusing that in. And 84% believe a workplace retirement plan with employer contributions is an important consideration when choosing a job. And to speak to what Jim was just talking about, as far as the benefits that unfold because of the transition from the defined benefit to the defined contribution, there's been a lot of changes within the workplace and some of the provisions out there. So 70% of employers offer a Roth provision within their 401k now. And that can be a very strong savings tool for the millennial generation for saving for retirement, especially with where we see taxes going in the future.
Are there a lot of millennials that are, for example, in the stock market or deciding between bonds and stocks and other investments, or are they just satisfied to allow their benefit plans, their financial advisors, to do that, those working with their employers?
Well, some of the benefits that have unfolded over the years is that there's better technology and there's a better alignment with your risk tolerance and your time horizon with some of these retirement choices that are almost automated for you, autopilot. piloted for you. So there, it does take some of the guesswork out for millennials. But as far as savings and outside of their retirement plans, you do see some folks getting more interested in technology and some of the apps out there like Stash, trying to better understand how to navigate the stocks, bonds world.
You know, we talked earlier about the recession, the Great Recession of 2008, 2009. It's a term that that I hear being used is that your generation, Jonathan, has recession anxiety. That, you know, maybe may not be as quick to invest or maybe a little bit leery of some of these things that have come before.
Absolutely.
Because the next recession may be just around the corner.
Yeah. I mean, first going back just as he was saying with the number of millennials participating in a workplace retirement plan at 45%, that statistic sounds great, but the actual reality behind it is that statistic is totally irrelevant, and it's only irrelevant because while more people are contributing than, say, Generation X, they're not contributing enough, and that you have to drill deeper down to see if someone's creating a workplace retirement plan, so let's say, for example, a 401k, but you're only contributing 1% of your...
Well, what should they be contributing?
I don't know. It totally depends on every single person, and the problem is that society has gone down this path where they want everything right now. We want immediate gratification and we want the answers right away. And so everyone's following generalistic templates of how much you should save for retirement, how much you need to put into your budget for savings or anything else. And that's a problem, again, why I wanted to write this book, because many of millennials in my generation and generations before, they follow these generalistic templates, but our generation now more than ever. And so if the masses are all doing the same thing, you're never going to be different than anyone else, which means you're going to have the same problems that everyone else has, which is why so many have the problems that they do nowadays with debt or not having enough for retirement. It comes down to being individualized. It's very personal how much money someone should be saving. So me versus Catherine, we have two totally different lives. And even if we had the same amount of income, keeping it equal doesn't mean that I should be saving the same amount that she should be saving because of whether or not she's a child and I don't have a child, or what her expectations
are. You're a car
guy
and she's not.
But Don, we do know that 1% is not going to cut it.
Exactly,
so
yes.
We, you know, the general rule of thumb is the 10 to 15% range of your salary.
And a lot of that depends on what your employer is matching to.
Right, you at least want to get that. Say? Yep.
And to that point, I mean, one of the biggest mistakes I think employees at all generations make is they do not max out that employer match.
Exactly, yes.
You are literally leaving money on the table if you don't get to that employer's maximum amount. I mean, it literally is money on the table that you're throwing away because they're going to match whatever you put into it. So I think that's
free
something.
Money.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's always the first thing when anyone I talk to is, what are you putting into a retirement plan? I'm sure you do the same thing, mm-hmm. Catherine. Yes, I'm like, if you're not putting in the match of your employer, you're literally giving up free money.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So we only have about 3 minutes left, and there's so much more we could talk about. But you've touched on some of these things, but and I don't want to just hold it to millennials, but those Gen Xers that we've heard from as well, because they have more years even that they have to think about this. What are some of the good strategies? I mean, you just talked about maxing out on, you know, matching exactly the maximum of what your employer is paying into a 401k. If you were to give Gen Xers or millennials advice right now, maybe they're thinking about it for the first time after hearing this program today, what would it be?
I would say find a financial fitness coach is the first thing I would say, beyond anything. That's the most important thing. Find someone that is going to be your guide. And in the world that we exist, there's a lot of stuff out there, but finding the right person who's actually going to ask you the specific questions about your life. And the most important thing is someone who holds you accountable.
Yeah, I agree with all
that's
that.
That's what this is. Mm-hmm.
I think that's important. But along those same lines, if you're not seeking help, is to educate yourself, ask questions. Mm-hmm. Google, use some, read a little bit and take the time for yourself, invest in yourself and take the time to read and understand these things better and utilize the education if your employer offers it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And from the higher education perspective, FIA, for example, we have a lot of resources online. We actually have higher education assistance partners that are embedded in the communities. They go to the high schools. They talk to the parents. They talk to the students. Try to get that education as early as you can so you can start getting into those good financial habits.
You know, I have to wonder, though, And I know that schools, they're being pulled in a lot of different directions. But when we talk about that financial literacy, even if it's just a class in a semester, that would seem to be very important nowadays.
Yeah. Oh, it'd be profound.
It would be, I mean, because, and I guarantee we have educators out there say, we would love to be able to do this, but here's what we're told we have to do. But Catherine's kind of gets back to what you're saying. If you're not going to have that in school or your parents, you know, we've had a couple emails here from listeners saying their parents did a wonderful job with educating them when it came to money. That's good.
That's
because
great.
Because there are a lot of other parents that maybe didn't because they, just as you described, they weren't, I could say my own parents weren't educated along those lines. And, you know, so we kind of, my sister and I kind of picked up what we could as we went along the way. I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. A lot of great food for thought. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we talk about, well, we talk about fitness and we talk about good health. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. So be sure to tune in.